Will you pray with me? May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts and the living of our lives please you, God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. I picked up a little book a few weeks ago called The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. I bought it because a friend told me this book had changed her life. And we're always looking for something that promises to change our lives, right? This book is a guide to getting rid of the things that clutter your home and your life. Clothes, paper, even books. The author, who is from Japan, makes it sound very simple, very zen. I'll let you know when my life is changed. Her basic method is discard anything that doesn't spark joy in you. And then she says this. She says, when we really delve into the reasons for why we can't let something go, there are only really two: an attachment to the past or a fear for the future. Either one of these thought patterns can make it hard to throw things away, she says, because when we are focused on either the past or the future, we can't see what we really need now, at this moment. And when we're unsure of what we need in the present, we tend to keep adding possessions in the illusion that they will make us feel full and well, satisfy some hunger that really isn't about possessions at all. I think she's right about our tendency to get caught in the past and the future. Anxiety is another word for what she's describing. Anxiety often comes from a fear of what the future might bring, especially if we're afraid that it might bring suffering. But it can also come from our inability or our unwillingness to accept the past and the ways that past has shaped how things are now, the way I am, my relationships, my sense of my place in other people's eyes. Our disappointment is already there. We carry it in our eyes, and so we project it onto other people and onto the rest of the world. We have been disappointed before, and so we are sure that the future will also fall short of our hopes. Anxiety may be one of the most common parts of human experience. We all know what it's like to have butterflies in your stomach before you have to speak in public, or to worry when someone you love doesn't get home on time, or to fear whatever it is has made that noise in the dark. But there's a more pervasive and longer-lasting anxiety, the kind that doesn't go away when the noise stops or your loved one arrives. It's inside of us, and it shapes the way we see everything around us. We obsess about our bodies, our food, our money. We worry about things that are out of our control. We fear losing someone we love, and so we grasp and cling and smother. We catastrophize small difficulties as if dark clouds are our home and our energy. We worry as if we could change things by thinking about them more. We can drive a whole system, a life, a family, a community, even a nation, on the energy of anxiety and fear. And it is toxic. It can kill us. This is what Jesus was talking about in the part of his Sermon on the Mount that Steve read this morning. Your anxiety is more dangerous to you than whatever it is you're anxious about, Jesus said. Clothes, food, money, a place to live, they are important. Important enough that God has made sure that even creatures that can't take care of themselves, like flowers and birds, have them. It isn't those things that are harmful to you, Jesus said. It's your constant worry about them. It niggles at the back of your mind. It digs holes in the foundations of your relationships. It gets in your eyes and fogs up your vision so that you can't see anything else clearly. And then he says this: anxiety and judgment are related to each other. They're sisters, joined at the hip. Anxious people are judgmental people. When we are anxious about our own well-being or whether we are good enough, we project our vulnerability and our fear onto other people. In our minds, and sometimes with our words and our actions, we compare ourselves with others. We compete for limited space in the arena of what seems best or even acceptable. And ultimately, we condemn, as though our judgment of other people can form a kind of shield around us. Someone else has to look like less so that we can feel like more. When you are driven by your anxiety, Jesus said, it's like you have a log in your eye. It can't help but distort other people's view in your eye. It can't help but make their flaws seem bigger. Franciscan priest and theologian Richard Rohr put it this way: we don't see things as they are, actually. We see things as we are. Almost all spiritual teachers, Jesus, the Buddha, Muhammad, the Dalai Lama, all of them have said the same thing: do not judge. They knew that fear and judgment keep us from seeing truly, opening our eyes so that we can be fully present. If we start by labeling, analyzing, categorizing things as good or bad, jumping too quickly to I like it or I don't, it's like we put a layer of no in between us and the people and things that come into our vision. A layer that keeps us from understanding, opening our hearts. Now, this doesn't mean that we have to take in everything we see. No can be an appropriate word, even a sacred word. But starting with no often means that we are so defended by our immediate judgments that we can't accept something new, so defensive that changing our minds becomes impossible. This is hard. For many of us, our tendency to move quickly to judgment is a lifelong pattern, hard to manage, just like our anxiety. But Jesus isn't just drilling us to muscle up and get this anxiety problem under control. Instead, he makes an amazing, almost unbelievable promise. He says, if you seek God's kingdom and justice first, if you love others before you spend all your energy trying to protect yourself, everything else you need, financially, physically, socially, will be given to you. Let me say that again. If you seek God's kingdom and justice first, If you love others before you spend your energy trying to protect yourself, then everything else you need will be given to you. Really? Did Jesus actually believe that? I heard someone say once that if you read that promise superficially, it could only have been made by a single guy living a carefree life on the beach in sunny Galilee. But I don't think that Jesus said it casually or flippantly. He meant it to sound as radical as it does. There is nothing moderate or commonsensical about this message. It is immoderate, risky, scarily absolute in the trust that it asks of us. As someone put it once, it's about a God who demands all and a God who gives all. I resist. I still want to make a case for prudence, the need for a reasonable measure of anxiety, a do-it-yourself responsibility for my own security. But the trial lawyer in me is collecting evidence, stories that might prove that Jesus knew what he was talking about. And I think those stories are everywhere around us. Lenora Bluen, who is sitting right here in the sanctuary this morning, told me just this week about a time when she was in college, far away from home, cut off from the family that had supported her emotionally and financially. She was so poor that she didn't know often how she would find her next meal. And every time, something came. Once it was a truck that was carrying corn that lost part of its load right in front of her on the street. Another time a check arrived, charity from a congregation that didn't know her at all, but surprised her with an act of generosity. Never very much. Never enough to take care of all the days ahead, but enough to get her through that day, that moment of worry. If I take seriously this teacher whose life I want to be the pattern for my own, I have to doubt my first reactions, my own lifelong patterns, my common sense that has been formed and nurtured by an anxious culture. Trusting things that are finite and scarce, Jesus said, will always get you in trouble. There will never, never be enough money, enough of other people's admiration, enough of your own power and control to make you well. When you trust in things that are scarce, you can't help but count and stockpile, compare what you have with others. When you trust in things that are scarce, fear and anxiety and judgment are natural. Instead, he said, put your trust in what is abundant, the things that will never run out or be eked out from a limited supply. Put your trust in the love and acceptance, forgiveness, and generosity of a God who doesn't keep track of wrongs, look for payment, or hoard power, ever. A God who is able to take all things, even something as fearful as death, and make life out of them. Richard Rohr made a list once of what a life looks like when it is freed from anxiety and worry and judgment. A joyful mind, he called it, and here are some of its characteristics. You no longer need to compare yourself with others. You no longer need to compete, not even in your own head. You don't need to analyze or judge things as in or out, positive or negative. Your mind is curious and interested, not suspicious and interrogating. You don't brood over injuries. You don't need to humiliate or critique or defeat people who have hurt you, not even in your mind. Your mind does not need to create self-justifying storylines. You do not need the future to be better than today. You can accept yourself as you are, warts and all. You can find truth on both sides of most things. You fill in gaps with the benefit of the doubt for both friend and enemy. You can wait and listen and learn. You can forgive and actually forget. And you find signs of God in all things. A joyful, unanxious, non-judging mind. It is possible. And it actually would change your life. May it be so for us. Amen.